I'm Alexander Hefner, your host on The Open Mind, and this is an audio podcast exclusive edition of the program. We're going to talk about disinformation today with a leading expert on the subject, disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, Nina Jankowicz. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Alexander.
So you have studied in particular the intersection of democracy and technology from both the European perspective and insights also into the American perspective now. And your book, your forthcoming book, How to Lose the Information War, was due out this spring. We were eagerly anticipating your arrival to our studio, but under the present circumstances, we still wanted to do something on the podcast. So thank you, and I hope to see you in person soon.
Thanks so much. Yeah, likewise.
So what have you found with respect to disinformation in the pandemic? Of course, you have a president in Donald Trump who is engaging in conspiracy mongering and disinformation on a regular basis. I mean, the most serious of which is he's telling people about medicine that is not medicine. Suggesting methods of curing or treating coronavirus that are unscientific and unrealistic and factually wrong. I mean, so you don't even need a whole online conspiracy network to boost that when you have the President of the United States once again boosting it himself. But what have you found in the United States and then more globally with how the disinformation infrastructure has been bolstered through this pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of senses, this is just a prime opportunity for disinformers of all stripes because people are so fearful right now. There's so much uncertainty, not only about the virus itself, but about, you know, when we're going to open back up, how our bank accounts are going to fare through all of this. So people are really searching for a lot of information. And the undercurrent of all of this, of course, as you know very well, is that our media environment is atrophying, not only during this crisis, when we've lost at least 28,000 jobs in journalism so far, and those tolls continue to mount. But, you know, the last couple of years when we've seen mass layoffs and closures across the entire media industry. So something has to fill that vacuum, right? And what's filling that vacuum increasingly is untrustworthy, sometimes malign information. Sometimes that's, you know, people who are trying to make a quick buck. Sometimes it's people who are spreading dis and misinformation for political gain. And sometimes we have foreign actors taking advantage of those fissures in our society as well. And I think we're seeing all of that coming to, you know, a head in the coronavirus crisis. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about what Russia and China are doing in this space. To me, it's not surprising at all that our adversaries, particularly ones that are adept at manipulating the information space, are taking advantage of this crisis. But what really worries me is, as you mentioned before, the Trump administration, through its really non-transparent communication, through the fact that we're getting mixed messages from the CDC and from the president himself, you know, we're leaving ourselves open to further manipulation. Again, whether that's coming from foreign or domestic actors, there's plenty to go around. And it's really worrisome and really hard to fact check because everything is so emotionally charged right now. And the best disinformation, it must be said, isn't just, you know, a cut and dry fake story. It is that sort of emotional manipulation that is grounded in some sort of visceral truth for people. And that's why we're going to, you know, be feeling the effects of this infodemic long after the pandemic itself is under control.
One of the interesting things about, I love the way you said, the visceral truth, which is sometimes guiding the malignant outcome and the misinformed and disinformed, that's something I've really emphasized on The Open Mind. The visceral truth of a personal, doesn't have to be a personal insight, but a personal gut. You know, the interesting thing about this situation is that popping, you know, the non-existent Lysol pills to cure your disease, I mean, that's just not possible. So, you know, it is possible to begrudge or resent a group of people because they've denied you economic opportunity, and as a result, you're going to buy into that disinformation. But do you think that the outstretched nature of life and death here, and the fact that the disinformation is not even really guided by the culture war per se, is going to enable us to win the information war ultimately?
Oh, you'd like to think that, but then we see things like these protests to reopen the economy where people are endangering themselves, their loved ones, and everyone around them by violating stay-at-home orders and demanding the economy be reopened. I think until people experience personally something, you know, an effect of this virus, we're going to have a lot of trouble undermining these pieces of dis and misinformation. I mean, people are, you know, claiming, in fact, that 50,000 Americans haven't died so far. They're claiming that the numbers are inflated because they haven't experienced a friend or family member being affected by the virus yet. And so they think there's some sort of, you know, nationwide conspiracy in order to control us and keep us in our houses and undermine the Trump administration ahead of the election. That's kind of the current of all of this. So when you believe and invest that strongly in those conspiracy theories, it becomes a very dire situation indeed. And, you know, it is important to note that the folks who are going to these protests, the folks who are considering, you know, ingesting harmful chemicals, those are fewer and far between. Most people are just quite confused right now. And again, I think that's where the administration has a lot of burden to bear, and they really have not been meeting those communication standards. The fact that the Trump administration is still holding in-person briefings, endangering staff at the White House and also the reporters going to those briefings on a daily basis. Nobody's wearing masks, right? Trump himself has said that he's not going to be wearing a mask. What sort of signal does that send to the American population if our CDC is saying everybody should be wearing masks when they're, especially when they're in close quarters, and yet our own president and the White House press corps are not made to do so? We should be doing those briefings digitally. A lot of other countries are. That sort of communication and example setting is really important in a pandemic like this. And in terms of the information component as well, again, we should be presenting a united front among the experts at the White House and the political officials. And we certainly have not been doing that. All sorts of mixed messaging happening, and the administration not owning up to its mistakes and instead trying to deflect them on other regimes like China, which of course contributes to the greater information warfare element here and opening us up to further manipulation.
So based on the book that you've just completed, How to Lose the Information War, there must be some thesis that you arrive at in terms of how not to lose it, right? Because so much of what's existing in the infrastructure now is already very tangibly losing it, and a large percent of the American population and the global population seeing that we are losing it. So did you arrive at any thesis as to how to not lose it?
Yes, of course. So the book looks at six different case studies, one from the United States and five from countries in Central and Eastern Europe that have been dealing with information warfare for a lot longer than we have. You could argue decades if you go back to the Soviet era, but certainly in the modern era, starting in Estonia in 2007 and going up to Ukraine present day, there are a lot of examples of information warfare there. And their governments have tried a lot of stuff. And, you know, having worked and traveled in those countries, it became clear to me as information warfare and disinformation entered the American consciousness in 2016 that we were about to reinvent the wheel. And I really wanted to make sure that didn't happen. And the things that I've noticed that unify these governments, which all have varied responses, some of them a lot more successful than others, is that there's always a homegrown element to information warfare operations. And this is mostly talking about the foreign disinformation, but certainly this applies to domestic disinformation as well. It's not just about trolls there are, you know, local vectors through which disinformation is spread. And it's really important to understand that when you're mounting your response. There's also, there needs to be a human element to countering disinformation. That goes back to that emotional, visceral truth that we were talking about before. There are, you know, groups of people that are targeted for a specific reason by malign actors, again, whether foreign or domestic. Groups like Russia and, you know, white supremacists here understand that, and they exploit those fissures in our societies. They exploit the tools that are available through social media to directly target those groups. And we can't legislate our way out of that. We can't just, you know, play whack-a-troll and hope that the social media companies remove all of those accounts. You know, we can't just sanction our way out of it and hope that, you know, we put enough sanctions on Russia, they'll stop doing this. Because again, we haven't solved the core issue, which is that those people are looking for something to fill that void. And so I'm a big advocate, and this gets to how we can win, of, you know, media literacy, digital literacy, awareness campaigns, so people understand how they're being targeted, because most people don't understand how social media is working, how it's trafficking in their data, and how that data is then available to bad actors who want to reach them for nefarious purposes. That's number one. But number two, you know, a lot of these folks who are buying into these narratives are activists in some ways. And they don't realize that they are targets for this information. Very famously, you know, we had a lot of Black Lives Matter activists who were roped into schemes with Russian trolls from the Internet Research Agency who were posing as Americans and funding their protest actions. That's about awareness building to some extent. But people also want to, you know, win arguments that are based in fact. They don't want to be proven wrong. So I would like to, you know, make sure people have the tools to navigate the information environment that we're in these days. And this sort of training and awareness building is certainly a generational project, but it's already shown dividends in countries like Estonia and Ukraine, which are, you know, by and large on the front lines of the information war and dealing with this on a daily basis and have been for the past decade or so. And they've shown some improvements. It's not a panacea. We need this in, you know, concert with all the other things that I mentioned, but it's something that we're extremely neglectful of during the Trump era, and certainly something I hope changes in future generations. But the most important thing I would say, and this is across all of the case studies that I've gone through in Europe, we cannot counter disinformation when we are trafficking in its tactics ourselves. I look at Poland as a case study in the book, and there's a lot of evidence that the Polish government these days has been using similar tactics to what the Internet Research Agency did on its own people in order to burnish its support within the Polish population. And while they, you know, are extremely wary of Russia and Russian influence efforts, it's very hard to push back against those Russian tactics when you're using them yourself. And certainly we're seeing echoes of that here in the United States. And I think that's one of the reasons that we've had such trouble pushing back against malign information actors on the international stage. Because again, we are using those very tactics ourselves. And that means there's an incongruence naturally in the policy we're trying to put forward.
Sure. Well, at least the Trump campaign did. And you know, now the Trump government is. But I wanted to turn your attention to Estonia, because the first exclusive podcast we did in the pandemic era, at least when society was viewing it that way, was with Paul D. Gregoria, who's an expert in election literacy, but specifically digital and electronic tools to teach and employ remote balloting, because that really appeared to be the most fundamental question from the perspective of a country that was born with the blessings of liberty, specifically the franchise, evolved to encompass the franchise for all of its citizens. With you know, I don't know if the literacy piece will be enough in terms of actively countering the disinformation culture. And I don't think you do either, but I want to just give you a chance to talk about that, because according to Paul D. Gregoria, Estonia, even with the influence of Russia geographically being, you know, more in close proximity, was able to foster what he says are free and fair elections including using some digital tools to enhance the democratic life there. But things like Amy Klobuchar's Honest Ads Act, which I will often bring up on The Open Mind, you know, those are sort of activating a philosophy towards the net and towards the digital infrastructure that that hasn't happened in America. But then there are even more drastic active steps that could be taken so that it's not just a preemptive strike on disinformation whenever possible, but it's actually sort of restructuring the grid so that it can foster more literacy in its nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And one thing I think that's important to point out about Estonia, they not only have digital voting, they really don't have to do any interaction with their government except for getting married, getting divorced, and buying real estate. Those are the only three things that you need to do in person in Estonia. Literally everything else you can do using your ID card, which everyone has a unique ID that is encrypted and uses two-factor authentication. And that's how people interact with their government, but that's built on a system of trust and transparency. Every Estonian citizen knows who has access to their data in their government. They know when it's been accessed. And that's just, as you pointed out, you know, something that is endemically not part of the American system yet. And I think as we have these scandals related to disinformation, related to online privacy, things like Cambridge Analytica, where we understand suddenly how much data is being gathered about us and what it's being used for, people are gradually becoming more aware of that. And things like the Honest Ads Act are, you know, baby steps in the right direction to building that trust and transparency in the United States. But we are not there yet. And yeah, I absolutely agree with you. The social media firms need to be doing a lot more to garner that trust. And they're making small steps in the right direction. But we cannot let them self-regulate because it's not in their interest to give up the data that is the currency that funds, you know, these massive empires that they have created. Unfortunately, because disinformation and things related to social media have become so politicized in this country, we have really, you know, we've stagnated in terms of regulating and thinking about oversight of these companies. And as a result, I think they're, you know, the single most powerful industry in terms of governing our discourse. And they have absolutely no congressional or government oversight. So we need that. I would love to see, you know, one thing they're discussing in the United Kingdom is taxing social media firms when they're found to have not protected their users from online harms, and using those taxes to then fund, you know, the types of awareness programs and media literacy building that I was talking about. But people need that media literacy in order to navigate their digital rights. Again, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and just lack of knowledge and awareness, period, of how the digital environment operates. People don't realize that there is no such thing as a free app, right? You're always giving something up. And all of this is very interconnected, and we really, really need a bit of a government steer here. And there's a lot to consider in terms of freedom of expression and the First Amendment when we get into that discussion that, you know, we've not even had those discussions at, I think, a very literate place in Congress. There's the very famous quote, of course, from Mark Zuckerberg, "Senator, we sell ads." Even the United States Senate didn't really understand how Facebook operated until after Cambridge Analytica. So we're getting there little by little. And if a nation like Estonia, which is small and only, you know, 30 years ago was still just breaking free of the Soviet Union, can do it, I think that the United States, with the biggest economy in the world and some of the brightest minds in technology and government innovation, we can certainly get there. We just have to put our minds to it.
Is it true that you can still buy ads on Facebook in Estonia? I mean, it sounds like they've been able to protect a libertarian or at least a rights-based economy and discourse, notwithstanding having those high-tech safeguards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure about political ads. I think there have been some changes in Europe, certainly related to political ads governed under the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which passed in May of 2018, or came into force in May of 2018, that govern how different citizens can be advertised to with regard to political and social issues on Facebook. And if I'm not mistaken, throughout the European Union, you can opt out of any of that. Which right now is not a right that American citizens have. We don't have a choice whether we receive political ads or not. And as we've seen during the coronavirus crisis, there are ways to disguise those ads. I'm not sure about Estonia and political ads necessarily. There are still, you know, wide social media usage in places like Estonia that are a bit more digitally woke, but I think they understand the implications privacy-wise of what that means. I would hope to see something like that being rolled out here in the United States. California has moved in that direction. They've passed some privacy legislation, but right now we have a very piecemeal approach. And there's a wide discussion about the balkanization of the internet. If the EU has this regulation and California has another one, but the laws in Ukraine are different, and certainly China and Russia have their own thing going with the social media firms, we're all going to be existing on different pieces of the internet at one point. And that's not what the internet was created to do. It was meant to bring us together. But how do we do that and preserve the democratic discourse that we need for our democracies to function? I think that's a question no one's really been able to answer yet, but it's good that we're finally having it.
but my question really just was, they have been able to preserve liberties and democratic discourse in Estonia. And, you know, let's not pretend like we don't have the capacity here to opt out and not watch a television station if we're gonna be inundated with ads, or to select a cable plan, YouTube TV, you know, any number of systems online or analog where you can avoid seeing ads, political or commercial. But what I was getting at is just that from the point of view of commerce and the point of view of politics, Estonia is a free and open society.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, Freedom House ranks them as the highest press freedom ranking in Europe. They've been able to not only integrate their government systems digitally and have this very successful digital democracy, but also maintain all those freedoms. Absolutely.
So how do you get folks not to poo-poo it? I mean, not to trivialize and marginalize and, you know, in the same way that, of course, Bernie Sanders encountered with respect to fusions of socialistic and capitalistic economic institutions in smaller European countries. I mean, the general response is just this closed-mindedness and like, oh, well, that's not our scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really nuanced question. And to get people to consider things with nuance, particularly when you're having discussions on the internet, can be pretty difficult. I think freedom of expression is a scale. There are standards that, you know, the UN and other bodies have set for all of their member states. And the United States is supposed to be leading in that. We're not supposed to be lagging behind in the pack. And I would say actually, and many people aren't aware of this, that the way that the system is governed right now, which is sort of this ad hoc system, means that, you know, there are certain people who are being left out of conversations and whose voices are being not heard because of the way that the social media firms and, you know, disinformation and things like this playing into all of these questions. Because of all of that, people aren't able to participate in the democratic conversation. And so it is, you know, de facto quashing speech instead of engendering more of it. And I think the more people realize that, the more people realize that there's actually not really, they're not in charge of the information they see on their Facebook feed or their Twitter feed or in their Google search results or YouTube algorithm. The more people are going to demand a bit more accountability from the social media firms, and that's going to require government regulation, plain and simple.
So you referred to the Honest Ads Act, Nina, as baby step, and we all are cognizant of the fact that, you know, it took such a drastic change of culture just in the documentary history of the United States, the book that I co-author. I always point out I included the transcript of Q&A from Richard Burr and the social media executive councils, who basically were admitting that they broke the law with respect to the ads that they were selling and not having the disclosure of who was buying political ads during the campaign. I mean, they were breaking FEC procedure, if not federal law, in doing that. So, I mean, baby steps are like, let's adhere to the law that we thought we understood was the law. In that spirit, is there any legislation that's been conceived? I think Chris Murphy, some other people, have maybe taken steps more drastically than the Klobuchar legislation, but is there any template for what a new Congress should consider more comprehensively in perhaps a new world order come January 2021?
Well, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's been sitting in the election security graveyard in Congress for years at this point, including the Honest Ads Act. Folks have looked more at more funding for election infrastructure for the states. There's been a little bit of that, but the real improvements that we need are going to cost money, and those bills have not made their way through Congress yet. There's a number of, you know, ways that we could better fund our activities abroad, including Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, which the president has started to attack recently, and I think are one of our strongest calling cards in authoritarian countries that don't have freedom of the media, don't have that independent journalistic tradition at this point, and certainly a strong element of American soft power, putting good investigative journalism out into the world. It's one of the most important things we can do to counter disinformation abroad. So I'd like to see all of that stuff funded more. But I know this will be near and dear to your heart, Alexander. I really think that we, the United States, need to invest more in our own domestic public media. So many stations, PBS and NPR, are the only local media in many pockets of rural America. And the fact that the United States spends $1.35 per person per year on our public media in a time where the information environment is atrophying in terms of good, you know, journalistic trustworthy sources, I just think it's absolutely shameful that we can call ourselves a developed nation if that's how much we spend. So I think investing more in the information environment is critical. And then there are a lot of proposals on the table for, you know, ways that we might conduct oversight over social media firms. And I don't think there is a consensus yet on what the best way forward looks like. But I think, again, talking about baby steps, one of the first things we need to do is bring our election legislation up to line with the digital age and make sure that those disclosures for political advertising on social media are codified, that the same rules that apply to TV, radio, and print apply to the online environment. That's number one. And then, you know, making sure those reporting mechanisms are in place so that the FEC, the FCC, the FTC, all of which oversee in part different parts of the social media empire, can bring those regulations to bear if they need to. And that might mean creating a federal commission on the internet so that those regulations aren't as piecemeal anymore. But again, not really a consensus yet because this topic has become so politicized in Capitol Hill, we've not really gotten to a fulsome discussion of what that would look like. And there's just a lot of proposals being bandied about at this point.
Final thought or question. We mentioned Estonia, and I'm glad to give you an opportunity to educate our listeners on that model. Of course, there's also Germany in the midst of this pandemic, which to date has had the best results per capita of survival and treatment, and notably through a robust testing regimen that has been applied thoroughly. You document case studies in the book, but with respect to science, you know, it's been noted that it's Dr. Merkel, you know, she has a science background versus our, you know, Jekyll and Hyde here. So, you know, of course it makes a meaningful difference who is inspiring the public policy making and enacting that policy making. But I just wanted to give you a chance on this intersection of pandemic and the focus of your scholarship, disinformation. You know, can Germany teach us anything at this moment in the same way we talked about Estonia?
You know, Germany is an interesting case study, at least from an informational perspective, because they've got the NetzDG law where, you know, if something is unlawful on the internet, the social media companies have to take that down within, I think, 24 or 48 hours or face a fairly hefty fine. And there's been some criticism of that law, you know, because they say that it actually stifles speech. It makes people less likely to post things on the internet and makes the social media companies more likely to be trigger happy in terms of taking things down. So I'm not sure that's a way forward in terms of a legislative response, but in terms of coronavirus and expertise, you know, I think Germanic populations are a bit more, the expert is still wholly there. And I think we're seeing a backlash against expertise. And, you know, we're seeing, for instance, Dr. Fauci called part of the deep state. And I think that is just a cultural difference. I am not sure if there is any policy prescription that could, you know, convince people who believe there is some sort of deep state apparatus keeping us all in our houses right now just to bring down President Trump. I'm not sure they can be reached, but there is a large portion of the American public who is just looking for trustworthy information and guidance, and we're failing them on that point as well. So if there's one thing we can learn from Dr. Merkel, it is that, you know, picture of calm, clear leadership during times of crisis. And hopefully that's something we can bring forward in the future.
Right. And your definition of free is always something that can be interpreted. But when freedom ought to coexist with human dignity and information integrity, then that's a whole calculus that ought to preserve those basic functions of civil society. Nita Jankowicz, author of the forthcoming How to Lose Information War, a pleasure speaking with you today, and hope to see you in the near future for an in-person recording too.
Thank you so much, Alexander. Great to be with you.
You're welcome.